Full Service Radio is proudly supported and hosted by Simplecast, the easiest way for a podcast creator to publish and distribute audio on the internet. For more information, visit simplecast.com.
Recorded live from the lobby of the Line Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C.
Good afternoon, and welcome to the Junctional Thinking Podcast, broadcasting live from the Line Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. I am your host, Pierre Vigilance, and welcome to the show. Over the years of my career so far, I've been fortunate to have been in a number of different sectors. So spent some time in the nonprofit sector after clinical training in emergency medicine, and then went on to government for a few years and then academia. And now in the space of strategic advisory consulting, I'm getting to interact with even more people who are very concerned about health and health outcomes. And in that journey, it's become more and more clear to me that we cannot continue to place all of the onus on health outcomes, on healthcare alone. That sector, while very well intentioned and capable with respect to disease management and care, is not what should be the sort of the be all and end all area or sector that handles health and health outcomes, because health outcomes are very complex matters that are a function of a number of different influences or determinants, as we've come to call them, ranging from transportation, housing, economic development, etc., all the way through to basics of education and where you live. So that notion is what sort of led me to trying to pull together this idea of junctional thinking, which is embodies consideration of a set of skills, behaviors, and ideals that we as health and human service providers and other social impact advisors need to be capable of in order to be functional at the intersection of all these different sectors. And so my conversations over the last couple of weeks, I was out in Denver with the Millennium Alliance. Shout out to the folks at Millennium Alliance for having me join them for facilitations of executive conversations with health executives out there in Denver from across the country, talking about population health. And then very much a great precursor to today's conversation, where I'm really, really happy to be joined by two friends of mine who, both of whom have been on a show here at Full Service before. I'm going to call you doctor. I mean, we've been talking about this for a minute now. It's done already. All right. We're claiming this. It's Dr. Veronica Vella, newly minted DRPH, and Dr. Kofi Essel, who are joining me from a couple of different roles. I'm going to let them talk a little bit about who they are and what they do. And then we're going to begin this pivot to what season three is going to be more about, which is sort of the business end of the tool. Very happy to talk about people's careers. That's great stuff. And people like hearing about your careers. But we're going to also try to get more of that. Like, how do we get this stuff done piece as well. So thank you both for joining me today. And we're calling this show Healthy by Design Part 2, because Veronica was involved with Part 1. And just a little bit about your background, sort of like your Cliff Notes version, because you've done a bunch of stuff in the design space and patient experience space. Go.
All right. Well, I was raised... I won't make this long, I promise. It sounds like it's going to be long. But I was raised in a family with a deep sense of social responsibility. And so I've always wanted to make sure that whatever I'm doing is improving the lives of others. And so I will say, like, that is a value that I have that runs deep throughout everything that I've done. But basically, the short story is I was very talented in math and science, went to engineering school, you know, did some work in education, realized I didn't want to work for a corporation. I wanted to do something that was more meaningful. Went back to school, ended up working in healthcare, where I was poised with roles around how do we redesign the services that we're delivering. So I've worked for Kaiser Permanente. I've done work for Centers for Medicare and Medicaid, the Department of Veterans Affairs, private healthcare system, so all kinds of different entities that are responsible for delivering care to different kinds of people.
Kofi, thank you.
You're welcome.
You gave me a warning at the beginning. It's going to be long, but it wasn't.
I know. That's why I told you it was going to be short.
Perfect. Kofi. You are a pediatrician here in the city, here in Washington, D.C. But tell us a bit about how you got to that point. Was that a straight line for you, straight through from undergrad or from the time when you saw a cousin fall out the tree and you wanted to help people?
So let me say first and foremost, I have a little cold, so excuse my nasal sound.
But you're still in the studio, and this is a public health show, yes. So you should be doing this on the phone.
Yes, or have a mask. Okay.
Terrible.
So here we go.
Terrible.
So,
All right, so we're all going to get started.
A little bit about my background. So I was born in London and moved to the States at the age of 4, grew up in Little Rock, Arkansas. Always wanted to be a clinician. My mom is a registered nurse, retired recently, and she's always quizzed me on bones of the body, muscles, and it was something she always drove home, this opportunity to be in healthcare, and it was something that I always thought was special. Every opportunity I had to do a summer program or any sort of medical-focused program, I always took that opportunity and made sure to take advantage of that. I went to the famous, infamous Little Rock Central High School in Little Rock, Arkansas, the first school to be integrated in the South. Great opportunity there. And from there, transitioned to my experience at Emory University. At Emory University, I studied anthropology, nutrition, culture, and that's really where I developed that interest to dive deeper in culture, social determinants. Those are the things that I learned earlier on in my experience at Emory University. After a few attempts, I got into medical school. So I got into medical school, came here to George Washington University School of Medicine, joined a community health track. Initially didn't know what I was going to do, had no idea. I always played sports my whole life, played basketball up into college, and I thought, oh, well, I played sports, so I might as well be an orthopedic surgeon or sports medicine doctor. Very sort of rigid in my approach and understanding, but I knew I had an interest in nutrition, and I learned had that interest back in college. I remember asking someone, do doctors do work in nutrition? I don't see that at all. And we sort of Googled some different opportunities over the summer, and I came across a wonderful internship. I got to work with one of 60 different mentors around the country. I picked a guy named Dr. David Katz at Yale University. At that opportunity is where I really started to learn about how I can bring these worlds together, nutrition, obesity, medicine, really bringing these worlds together. I thought that was really special for me. Now, pediatrics is its own ballgame for me, because when I started transitioning to my third year on clinical rotations and seeing a lot of different opportunities in medicine, surgery and different things, I knew I did not want to be a surgeon after my experience in surgery. But what I learned is that working with kids, there was so much joy in that. Kids were so resilient. There was opportunity for change there. I would work with adults, and families would be quite rigid, not willing to for behavior change and things like that. Mm-hmm. But when the kid was in the center, I saw families really put their child's health in the forefront,
right,
doing whatever it would take to really get the health, the optimal health for their child. So recognizing my role as an advocate in pediatrics was something that I recognized early on, and it just opened up a career for me in that realm.
Fantastic. All right, so this is good stuff. The reason why I thought it was interesting to have the two of you come in was because you both spent some time, and Veronica, I think it's fair to say you spent the most time of the three of us doing this work with using human-centered design or design thinking. And I know, Kofi, you sort of become a student of it and been trying to get more into how to utilize that particular set of skills in your work as well. But that's sort of the common thread, with obviously the patient at the center, like you were just referring to. But you know, one thing, and we were just talking about this before the show started, there's a lot of interest right now based around all the technology that's available out there to make use of data coming from different data sets and use that to predict people's behaviors, you know, artificial intelligence, predictive analytics, etc. But there are stories behind that data, right? And the anthropologist in you and the designer and systems engineer in you, Veronica, sort of get that part of things. But to some extent, we're pulling away from those stories when we focus on the numbers and the data that is spewed out by the various things that we do on the internet or in stores, etc. As you think about your individual practices related to the patient experience, particularly in the spaces you've worked in, is this a concern? Is what I'm referring to just a concern that I have, or is this a real valid concern that we may be skewing ourselves a little too much towards the machine learning stuff and not necessarily taking as much time as we need to be taking around the people learning stuff. So, whoever wants to sort of jump in.
There was recently an article, I think in the New York Times, that was talking about artificial intelligence and machine learning. I can't remember where it was published, but basically there's bias built into some of the algorithms. So there were a group of researchers, I think from Berkeley, and some other schools that came together to analyze an algorithm that was, you know, solving some sort of problem for predicting something about patient and behavior and response. And they found that it was grounded, you know, every data model has assumptions that underpin it. So if those assumptions are wrong, then the whole model is skewed.
Right.
So, and people who develop models, we understand that. I had in a former life, I've done that before. And so the first thing you do is you outline, here are all the assumptions that I'm making. Because if those assumptions don't hold true, then we know that we can't use this model to predict something about this data.
Right.
So right. I think it's a wonderful tool. You know, models are actually used by companies like UPS that distribute, you know, they have transportation models where they're going to predict how long is it going to take? When are you going to get this package, right?
Absolutely.
And there are hundreds of people, mathematicians and programmers working on those models. Number one, they're extremely expensive to do. A service like UPS is so much more predictable than health and or behavior. When you start talking about like epigenetics and people's responses to medications based on gender, you know, other genetic factors. So I think the way that mathematicians see models is we see it as a tool to help solve a problem, but we know that the model is just one framing of a view of the problem. We know that it can't actually replicate the real life scenario because in order to do that, it's too many variables, it's too complex, it's too nuances, and there's too many different scenarios and possibilities and permutations off those possibilities. You can't possibly model all of that. Now, people at NASA, they do that too, right? They have to develop models about the spaceship and where it's going to go and where it's going to land. But think about the amount of brain power that it takes to do that work, okay? And then think about the complexity of the human being and the decisions and the choices and all of the things that underline what we do and how we do that.
And influence us, yeah.
So I'm saying they're tools, but they cannot predict everything with accuracy.
It shouldn't be used in isolation. Kofi, you got any thoughts with respect to...
I think, first and foremost, this was brought up to me years ago as well, and as a primary care provider, it's kind of scary. People have mentioned to me, your job won't be there in a few years. You need to sort of shift out and think about other ways of doing the work that you do. That's a scary thing to think about, to invest so much time over so long and then say, well, that's going to be taken from you. There's something about empathy that's missing there. Mm-hmm. If you want behavior change, if you want to meet someone where they are and walk with people during a process, empathy is necessary. And I see that time and time again, anecdotally and from the data. And I think that's something that's often missing with those elements. Now, can you combine them and bring them in into an experience? I think that's really important. I think about analogies with a lot of sports commentators. They're getting really frustrated nowadays because of analytics kind of really jumping in and pushing those who have played the sport for so long and saying that their voice is not as necessary. But you have the Charles Barkleys, you have these other voices coming in to say, hey, what we see, this feel, this experience is still genuine. It's still something that really can get us a better understanding. So sorry to shift over there really quickly, but I think it's a valuable thing to understand and think about. But I think that empathy piece is something that I think we can't take away. And I think it's something you can't substitute.
Mm-hmm. Right. I think you're saying the same thing. It's just that, no, there's no substitute for the human element in the equation, right? Be it commentating on sports. I mean, I watch a lot of soccer, as you know. VAR is killing me right now. Video assisted, whatever, replay thing. Anyway, but I think that it's, even though we're addressing complex problems, it can seem easier to let the machine learn whatever it's going to learn and then have it tell us something. the only flaw being, as you pointed out, that it's a machine that's learning, and it only learns what you from what you put into it, right? It's not, the machine isn't walking around and, like we were talking about last time, smelling the caramel popcorn thing coming right out of the store. Right. It's not, it doesn't have a budget that only allows it to buy a bag of chips and soda on the way to school, because it's, you see what I'm saying? It mm-hmm. doesn't have those experiences. So because it doesn't have all of that context, it can only learn but so much, which right. will make it such that algorithms that it spews out are going to have limited context.
Right.
You are listening to the Junctional Thinking Podcast on Full Service Radio, broadcasting live from the Line Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Pierre Vigilance, and today I'm joined by doctors Veronica Vela and Kofi Essel, who are talking about healthy by design and actually how do we get to improving on the patient experience. We were just talking a little bit about machine learning and stuff. I think, Veronica, you were going to say something.
Yeah, it escaped me.
It's no problem. Sorry.
There's we'll just come to back make sure to it we if it's important. It'll take come
a back. Course of the course real quick there. But I think something that you said just now, Kofi, though, about feel. And, you know, in the School of Public Health at GW, we had a leadership course where we started talking to people about, like, well, okay, soft skills versus hard skills, or verticals versus horizontals. And I prefer that term, verticals versus horizontals. People were saying soft skills were things like communication and leadership and empathy, etc. And the hard skills were things like policy analysis and epidemiology, etc. Mm-hmm. I don't like the soft versus hard. They're all hard. The
yes,
vertical,
they are.
Vertical versus horizontal is a bit easier or better way to do it. Verticals being the specific like sector stuff, and the horizontals being the skills that cut across sectors.
Mm-hmm.
Feel is a horizontal skill, right? I don't care what sport you're playing. If it involves a racket, bat, club, or anything like that, if you grip that thing as hard as you can, your swing is not going to be nearly as effective as if you have more of a dynamic grip, if you feel it as opposed to, like, grip it. How have you seen feel and empathy actually quickly be able to change an engagement outcome as you've gone in to deal with and talk to people that you're working with? I know you've done a lot of work with veterans and obviously some work with women, HIV. I mean, there's a whole bunch of different space there. And then Kofi, if you could think about that from the perspective of the obesity work that you do.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a really interesting project that I worked on that was looking at women, vulnerable women, and whether or not they would be willing to take a home HIV test. Because the same way that we have a home pregnancy test, we now have a home HIV test that you can buy at a pharmacy.
Right.
And so the idea was, if we armed people in the community with these home tests, then they would know more quickly whether or not they had HIV, right? Because they just do it at home. It's a $25 test. They don't have to go into a clinic to wait to find out, which then you wait, you know, a couple days for the blood to be processed. So there was this idea that, you know, we would learn about the prevalence of HIV much faster, and then we would get people into care quicker. And so when I heard about this, I was like, oh, this is awesome. So CMS gave like $22 million for this randomized controlled trial to deploy all these home tests in communities where there were high risk of HIV. And what they found was that they were not able to enroll people in the study. So I, in parallel, I learned about this study. I became really curious, and I started looking at Black women in Washington, D.C. who are at greater risk for HIV. And so I wanted to understand, well, what did they think? Would they be willing to take a home HIV test? Would they rather be in the clinic? What were their fears around test taking and HIV? And what I learned was with the group of women that I spoke to, who were all vulnerable from, you know, under-resourced communities, limited services, healthcare, grocery stores, you name it. What I learned is that while they thought it was cool to take the test at home, they were actually more interested in taking it at a clinic because they did not want to be alone when they found out about the HIV test. They wanted to be where the services were, right? And so conceptually, we have this brilliant idea and we create this product that we think is going to revolutionize and help stop the spread of HIV within the city of DC. But the solution is disconnected from the understanding of the reality of what people are dealing with. You know, a lot of, especially with women, you know, single family, head of household, on their own, caring for children, limited resources. Okay, then you find out you have HIV. What are you going to do? Yeah, and you're by yourself in your bathroom.
Right.
So, I mean, so that's, to me, a clear example of where empathy and understanding and sitting in someone's shoes before you think about what is the intervention that we're going to spend a lot of money on. Imagine what could they actually ended up canceling that project. What could they have done with those $20+ million for these same people?
Okay. That's a great example. Kofi, what are you thinking?
So I was thinking of a few different examples. One in particular was some work I did with training my residents in particular. So pediatric residents in general, a lot of us don't get a lot of training around nutrition, obesity. Those are areas that we don't get to explore as much in medical school, medical training. This is an area we're trying to address better now. One of the things that I did as a after I finished residency, as I worked with our pediatric residents to give them an opportunity to create more tailor-made interventions for their families. So what does that mean? So working with their families in their communities that they're seeing patients in, allowing them to identify families that want further help with around weight management in particular. And what the residents were able to do is to go into their homes, do a screening or an evaluation of the environment, their neighborhood, to get a better understanding of what resources are available and also get a sense of how can I better tailor my intervention for the family. One of the things they noticed was when they went into the homes of their families, they recognized, hey, all this time I've been screening or been asking my families questions and been counseling them, I've been counseling from an understanding of they have a table in their house with chairs around it, they're eating around the table. All this time when I've been counseling my family, I've been counseling from a perspective of there's a large front and backyard. But they go into their homes, they go into their environment, they're like, whoa, this is not what I grew up with. Right? So all this time they've been creating these notions and these understandings from their own past experiences. So one of the things that we saw time and time again was when they were able to go into the spaces, take off their white coat, get out of their safe space, go into the spaces of their families, yes. It really shattered their preconceived notions, yes. To be able to connect with them and actually be able to help them more effectively in that way. And I think that was really important for them.
That's huge.
That's a great
huge.
Example.
Very, very good examples. We are going to be right back in a couple minutes. You've been listening to the Junctional Thinking Podcast, broadcasting live from the Line Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C., and we'll be back in just a second. Welcome back. This is Junctional Thinking, the podcast, broadcasting live from the Lion Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. I am your host, Pierre Vigilance, and I am joined today by Dr. Kofi Yassel and Dr. Veronica Vela, who are talking about a few different things. We opened up talking about machine learning, versus people learning. I actually just came up with that people learning phrase. So if anybody wants to use that, call me and I may give you permission to do so. But people, like, because people are about machine learning and people learning. So
people,
like,
learning.
We should use people learning as opposed to just machine learning. And we agreed that there was a good combination of people learning and machine learning that should be used to make decisions about how we sort of create the algorithms that allow us to decide what we're going to do with and for people. Yes. And then we talked a bit about empathy, which some people consider to be a soft skill. We said it's not soft, it's actually quite difficult and it's very necessary, but it's definitely horizontal because it can cut across a number of different spaces. Both of you have worked in large institutions, and it's fair to say that you will probably go on to work in and lead even bigger ones in both of your careers. You have the opportunity to partner right now with certain people and certain types of people, certain types of organizations, etc. As you think about the work that you're doing, and you can use this as a complete guilt-free plug moment to sort of say, look, I would love it if I could get to work with, or we, my organization, my families could get to work with X, and sort of the and why. And I mean, if that doesn't stir up anything for either one of you right now, I have a couple, but go ahead.
Okay, so these are not my organizations, but these are organizations that I have a dream of them working together.
With you.
With me, of course.
Yes.
Okay, so one of my dreams is for the health insurers to work with functional medicine so that they start addressing functional medicine doctors and naturopathic medicine, so they actually start addressing illness from a state of helping optimize function. So you're doing it actually before it gets to disease. So I want health insurers to understand the value of optimizing function and make that what they get good at.
Is that another way of saying pay for prevention?
That's another way of saying pay for prevention, but it's not, but I don't want to call it prevention.
I know you don't. That's why
I want to call it optimizing function.
What's the difference?
Optimizing function. So functional medicine doctors focus on how do I get your body to perform in its optimal state? So how do I get all of your organs to do all of the things that they need to do with the air and the blood and the food so okay. that you are a well-oiled machine?
Okay. All right. So now let me pivot for 1 second. That's a great one, because we have somebody who is engaged in that, some of that work, especially with kids, right? I mean, because I think that would be how do you react to that? Is that something that you could see it being applicable to kids, or is it more about their parents? Who is this more about?
I think my first reaction, we've talked about this a little bit, but I think my first reaction is, how does that happen with so much of this? We see disparities so far and commonplace, and I'm just wondering, how do we sort of tailor that for all of these families when they're still trying to access even the basic, you know, optimal care in the environments that I work in? So I don't know. That's the first thing I started thinking
about. I don't think that they're mutually exclusive, right? So you could have someone who has a serious condition that they're working, that they have to deal with. So, for example, I have a person in my family who's having oral surgery this Thursday because she has an infection in her mouth that she's had for a couple years that she's tried flossing. I mean, every single way to clean your mouth, this woman has tried it, okay? And so, you know, I was having a conversation actually over the holiday with my nephew who's 5 years old on bacteria and microbes and how there's good and bad bacteria and how we need both. And, you know, our immune system is based in our gut and has to do with our bacteria, right? So my mom, so the person in my family is going to go have this surgery, right? Which is a medical way of dealing with the problem. But I'm like, Mom, you need to start taking probiotics. You need to look at what is in your gut bacteria that your body cannot fight it. So that's where the naturopathic medicine is, in the gut bacteria, analyzing the microbiome. And then you have the oral surgeon who's performing whatever they need to do to get her condition to a place where at least she can, you know, remove the infection. So that's how I think they work together. I don't think they're separate.
So I think the other part too is, unfortunately, naturopathic medicine in allopathic medicine, they don't always play well in the sandbox together. And even work I do in nutrition is often viewed as sort of, you know, alternative medicine. And I think that that's something that's a problem in itself. But I think also the other challenge is also getting the data behind that to put large amounts of money behind that to support some of these efforts.
It takes 17 years for our healthcare system to take findings and put them into practice. So I don't think that it doesn't exist. I think it's we have a resistant system, but also you have to take that data and information and make it digestible to the people who then can take action on it. So it's translating the science, but it's also being much more agile and open to information. I think it's both. And I think the other thing I will say is, like, you know, this is why I said health insurers, right? Because the question then becomes who pays for this, right? So who recognizes this as a valid form of treatment? Well, we all know that our healthcare system is dominated. The way that we think of well-being is dominated. It's over-medicalized, right? And so that's a function of all of our associations and institutions that lobby for the healthcare system to be arranged in this particular way. So it's asking us to do things that are alternative or more natural is very unconventional to the structures, and it's the inconvenient truth of health and wellness.
You know, as I listen to both of you to sort of think about this, the thing that concerns me about the engagement of payers, and this is not just a disclaimer here, this is not a slight against payers at all, but it is to say that in order for a payer to have to pay on a claim, someone has to become a patient for that to happen, right? Mm-hmm. Meaning that if you don't engage in the healthcare system, you're not a patient. You are just somebody who is a member of society, right? We don't have you counted. We don't have your saliva, blood, DNA. We don't have any of your weight. We don't know anything about you, right? But as a community and as a population, we know on aggregate various bits of information based on where people live, what their income levels are, what they have had access to eat, etc., or how they eventually ended up presenting. So what I'm saying is that we have patients at the tip of an iceberg with respect to a community, right? Because they're the ones who have engaged. They're the ones who you can say, okay, well, maybe you should try something different. And maybe try to figure out how to get them to do something different. But what about all those other people? Because you know how icebergs are, right? The tip of the iceberg's the little part. The big part's underneath the water. Those are all these people who are out there who are continuing on a day-to-day basis because of the challenges that we've all been talking about to live a particular way. Again, no indictment there, just the reality of their daily living function, etc., that doesn't involve enough sleep, that doesn't involve enough of the appropriate nutrition, that doesn't involve enough of the appropriate movement, and doesn't involve a particular level of education, da-da-da-da-da. So in that context of the pipeline of people coming up to become the tip of the iceberg, coming from spaces where we don't touch them, I don't know that I want to wait necessarily for people to be covered by an insurance that only covers the tip of the iceberg.
Right.
For me to be able to impact the tip of the iceberg. I feel like we need to figure out how do you get under the surface of the water to the big part of the iceberg underneath there in the places and spaces where people are regularly interacting in that water, right? And figure out how to do something about arguably preventing them from ever becoming part of the tip of the iceberg, right? As opposed to waiting. So I agree with you. Yes, we have to do what we have to do for the tip of the iceberg because that's the part we can see. But, you know, getting underneath the waves to understanding and doing something about people before they become patients is, I think, important. The problem is health care equals patient. And so when we stop talking about patients, then healthcare says, hey, it's nothing to do with me. But then we are population health people or public health people. Mm-hmm. So we're concerned about everybody.
We are.
Right? Maybe to a fault. So I don't know. Perfect partners. Kofi.
Yeah, so perfect partners. So I think kind of in line with what you're saying, especially in the work that I do around food security and obesity, I think about bringing together different partnerships, including clinical community partnerships. And that's a term that I've been exploring more over the last few years. I think there's a lot of rapport that clinicians have with patients and families, and I think building off of that is great. But I don't think the clinician should be the center of care by any means. I think they're a part of the puzzle, and I think that's a really important piece to think about. So with the community partnership, clinician community partnership, or community clinician partnership, however you want to look at that power differential, I think of different groups. So working with kids and families, I think about bringing local school districts on board. I think, again, having that messaging consistent in the clinical space as well as in the school space, I think helps. A lot of the interventions we see that's done just in schools, it's okay. But again, there's not that consistency across the board. Some of the partners that I'm thinking about even right now, in particular that I'm working with, are organizations that work in the school space and doing a lot of nutrition education, doing a lot of that on the ground physical activity work, which is great, again, but that's only localized there. How do we make sure that's consistent even in the adult care providers' offices, in the pediatric offices, in the YMCAs, in the Common Threads organizations, American Heart Association? So for me, it's bringing together these policy figureheads, the local schools, local community centers, and also the smaller organizations as well, smaller community organizations with clinical community partnerships.
How do you react to this? The idea that the conversations we were having a couple of weeks ago, a couple of different presenters talked about three companies in particular and their role in the future of health. Those three companies were Apple, Amazon, and Google, right? And as we think about those three entities individually or collectively, Do any one of them make you think about ways that a partnership with any of them might be beneficial to the communities that you serve or the work that you're doing?
So one of the programs that I've been exploring a lot recently are food as medicine programs.
Yep.
So food as medicine is a hot new topic. A lot of people are trying to really dive deeper in food security and hunger, recognizing it and the prevalence of it around the country. One of the strategies that we've seen that can be effective is, instead of waiting for the family to come to you all the time, how about we can support the family and sometimes be able to provide healthy food and nutrition directly to that family for a variety of reasons in a variety of different ways.
Okay.
One of the ways is, so SNAP is running a pilot in a few different states where they're delivering food to the homes of families.
SNAP, just for our listeners who may not know what it is, because in Philly, SNAP is like actually a food store, but you're referring
to... Yeah, so SNAP is AKA the food stamp program. It's the largest federal nutrition program in the country, and the majority of families that are struggling with food security are using or are getting to benefit from the SNAP program.
Thank you.
So with SNAP, this pilot that's being run is actually helping deliver fresh fruits and vegetables to families throughout the country in different states. It's a pilot. And that's something we haven't seen the data from yet, but we're excited to see what's going to happen with that. Amazon in particular, now that they have combined with Whole Foods or purchased Whole Foods, thinking about ways in which fresh fruits and vegetables can help be delivered to our families is a way that I think would be huge for some of the work that we're doing to really decrease some of those disparities, especially around food deserts or low food access areas and lack of grocery stores and things like that. And of course, if it's present, one of the things that I've seen is some of the programs that I've done where we do that, families are now eating fruits and vegetables that they typically don't. What's on display is not always the chips and the sodas and things like that. Now they're having things on display that is prominent in their house. And also they're able to use their other resources to spend on other things that they need for their family.
Right.
Heat and other things that are
right,
really important.
The essentials.
For exactly. So it allows them to spread out their resources. So a group like working with Amazon, working in a program like that would be phenomenal.
Okay. I want to jump off of that. I want to do a little brainstorm. Because I think, you know, the other thing that would be interesting is to actually also bring like a Blue Apron or a Green Chef into that. Because they're, you know, the week prior, you pick out the meals that you want, they send you the recipes, right? So it's not only, you know, and I get Green Chef, which is like organic meals, and I get to, pick what looks interesting to me based on what my requirements are, or it could suggest certain types of food based on a certain person's condition or diet that they need to be mindful of, and then gives them the actual recipe for them to follow. So I think that that would be another way to enhance and build on this idea that you have.
I think the more autonomy, the better. The more you can put the power back in the family's hands, I think the better. So I love an idea like that. I think one of the challenges in working with populations that I work with is time as a variable. Working further away from home, time being taken by a variety of other, working multiple jobs, those kind of things, it makes it difficult to plan and to cook meals in a planned way. And also with cognitive bandwidth, with an increased level of toxic stress, it makes it difficult for me to shift and focus on a variety of different things and plan my meals for the week and all that kind of things. But I do think reducing some of those boundaries or those barriers by helping with bringing in easy 15-minute or less, 30-minute or less meals could be helpful.
Right. Yeah. I mean, and there's also the toxic stress associated with getting your deliveries, right? It's just that's a real thing, especially this time of year where folks are just sort of like, did the Amazon people come yet? That's a big issue, at least in my household. We have a few minutes left, and you've been listening to the voices of Dr. Kofi Essel and Dr. Veronica Vella on Junctional Thinking, the podcast. And I threw the Amazon, Google, Apple thing out there because they keep coming up as these players. Amazon obviously involved with Berkshire Hathaway and JP Morgan Chase with Haven, their new health system, the new health entity. We'll call it that. Apple, obviously, the wearables, the phone, and the opportunity for interaction between that and now with the Apple Watch being capable of providing some more information than we ever thought possible to providers directly, maybe tracking physical activity, etc. And then Google was just like all the information that is obtained through the Internet of Things and their obvious interest by virtue of who they've been hiring recently around this health stuff. And it's not to say that those three are the only companies, but the conversation that you two just had about the ways that the value or the authority of one of them, Amazon and its connectivity, and the functionality of something like a Blue Apron, etc., might need to be explored or could be explored. Very similar to what Eric Letzinger was talking about when he came in here talking about the work that they did with Meals on Wheels, right? And so, you know, to close out, I just wanted to see if I could just get from you like just a touch of future casting. Kofi, you touched on it at the beginning with respect to, I'm a pediatrician and my job might actually become obsolete at some point with respect to XYZ. If you're future casting with respect to your space, specifically obesity and children, what's coming next and what are the things, what's the thing that you're most excited about with respect to that? And then also the thing that you're most excited about with respect to just designing better patient experiences just in general. So go.
I think one of the most important things for us is even the awareness of what obesity is. I think there's incredible amount of frustration with clinicians or families or individuals when they look at obesity as a simple factor that happens to you when you just eat too many calories and don't work out enough. And when we simplify the disease to that, it increases our stigma towards individuals who have obesity. It doesn't really treat it for the complexity of the disease it actually is. Obesity is a multi-system, chronic, complex disease, and we need to treat it that way. So with an understanding of that and recognizing how hard it is, once you do lose weight and how your body will fight against you to get back to that set point it was before, recognizing that really allows us to extend an incredible amount of grace, an incredible amount of empathy, and work alongside with people. Now, I think that that's a huge piece of the next phase of clinician education, community education, and just recognizing what that is. On top of that, things like the sugar taxes and things like some of these upstream policy interventions are going to have huge opportunities. Our recognition and understanding of the effects of ultra-processed foods and how it impacts health in general, and recognizing how we need to move towards eating more whole and real foods. These are things that a lot of organizations are starting to really grasp and push us towards. And I think that's sort of the next phase in education, next phase in our understanding of the disease.
Good. Thank you.
So I had the pleasure in October of going to the health conference out in Las Vegas, which is a conference that brings together, all kinds of healthcare delivery systems, startup organizations, designers, and venture capitalists to talk about what they're doing in the future of health. And what struck me about that conference is there were three things that were really being talked about. And I'm excited about this because I found this inspiring, because it's also often you are working in your world and you forget that there are other people that think like you. And so one of the things that they talked about that was heavily emphasized, which was this notion of health equity. We actually had Bernard Tyson from Kaiser. This was literally like the week before he passed away. He gave a keynote talk and he was talking about health equity, and he was talking about social determinants of disease and what Kaiser's doing with housing out in California. So I think health equity, social determinants. I also think bringing in the design element and understanding, you know, there are all of these organizations that are going to disrupt the more traditional institutions. So there are, you know, primary care, health, you know, look at One Medical, right? That they're thinking about, like, how do we personalize the primary care experience, for example? And they are mindfully designing it, you know, and then you look at other companies that are, you know, redesigning what is a health insurer. So I think that what is most exciting for me is that there is a conversation about healthcare and how we deliver healthcare and how people respond to healthcare that is talking about health equity, that's talking about social determinants, and is talking about how we are designing for those. So I'm just so excited that there's like a group of people in the world that I know that I can come together with at least once a year and talk to about these ideas. Because I think prior to this, I think we were all in our own different worlds, different spaces, and not having the conversation. Yeah. And I think it needs to be the large institutions, the startups, the investors, and then the people doing the work, the design of the work, coming together, because they all need to know that they exist and they are disrupting each other.
This sounds like a junctional thinking conference.
Yes.
I think that could be a thing. And it just came to me just now. So very, very happy to have people call me about sponsorship opportunities with respect to that, obviously, because we would need to put some resources together to make that happen. But I think that could actually be a great cross-sectional conversation, such as the one we've had with you all today. Thank you so much, both
Thank
of you,
you,
for taking the time out to
Thank
come
you.
And join me on the show, talk a bit about the work that you're doing and relate it to, you know, this very, very strong need to really be about the people learning element of things, the empathy piece of things, and the understanding of the lived experiences that people have, the context in which they live their daily lives, and how they might be different than what we perceive them to be, but how we have to go ahead and ask those people questions and really understand and go to where they are so that we can really understand who they are and how they're living if we want to impact their health and health outcomes. Again, Dr. Veronica Vela, Dr. Kofi Essel, this has been another edition of the Junctional Thinking Podcast, broadcasting live from the Lion Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. I am your host, Pierre Vigilance, and I will see you again next time.
Thank you.
Thank you.